I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman is my guest today. Ellicott City has been hit by two deadly floods in less than 2 years. Property damage is even worse this time than in 2016, when Governor Hogan repealed the law requiring dedicated sources of funding for stormwater remediation. He and others, including Alan Kittleman, called it a rain tax. Mr. Kittleman opposed it and tried unsuccessfully to eliminate stormwater fees in Howard County. But can the kinds of projects funded by the remediation fees save Ellicott City and mitigate these deadly floods in the future? Can downtown be rebuilt? Should it be rebuilt? Alan Kittleman joins me when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to have a conversation about the future of Old Ellicott City. Alan Kittleman is my guest. He's the county executive of Howard County, elected to that position in 2014. On July 30th, 2016, Old Ellicott City was ravaged by what was called at the time a once-in-a-thousand-years flood. The historic downtown was largely rebuilt, residents returned, shops reopened, and less than 2 years later, on May 27th of this year, another deadly flood struck Old Ellicott City, perhaps even worse than the 2016 iteration. Two people were killed in 2016. Another lost his life this year. A state of emergency for the historic downtown is still in effect. In May of 2015, a year before the 2016 flood, Governor Larry Hogan made good on a campaign promise to repeal the law that required nine counties to charge residences and businesses a stormwater remediation fee to create a dedicated source of funding for stormwater projects. Mr. Hogan and opponents of the law referred to it as a rain tax. Alan Kittleman was a vocal supporter of repealing that law. Repeal was also supported by several prominent Democrats, including Senate President Mike Miller, Rich Modolino, Jamie Raskin, and Jim Rosapep. Mr. Kittleman was proposed a reduction and the eventual repeal of the stormwater remediation fee in Howard County, but that proposal was rejected by the county council. 9 days ago, Howard County residents received bills that included fees that ranged from $15 to $90, depending on the amount of impervious surfaces that they have on their property. But even with revenue dedicated to fixing the kind of problems that contributed to the severity of these most recent floods, questions remain about whether or not any amount of stormwater remediation can save Old Ellicott City if another flood happens. A little later in the program, we'll take your calls and comments. What do you think about the future of Ellicott City? Should it be rebuilt? And if so, under what conditions? We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. As I said, we'll take your calls, your emails, and tweets a little bit later. Alan Kittleman, welcome back to Midday. It's good to see you, sir.
It's very nice to be here, Tom. Thank you.
So what's the status of the recovery as we speak today?
Well, again, the most important thing is to talk about the people of Ellicott City and how resilient and amazing they are. They continue to inspire me and energize me every time I'm down there with them. It's going as well as you could be expected to have such a terrible thing happen so close to the previous flood. We're actually probably much farther ahead of schedule than we were in 2016. Unfortunately, we have some experience in disaster recovery in Howard County and especially in Ellicott City. And so we have, a lot of businesses are already reopened. The road itself was not as damaged as much as it was in 2016. I think what's important for people to realize is the things that we repaired after the 2016 flood held. It was the older infrastructure that was not repaired, that wasn't damaged in 2016, that got damaged this time. So I'm optimistic. I know the county council, and I appreciate them extending the emergency declaration through July 30th. It is actually our goal to open up the road and to end the emergency declaration before then. And we're working very closely with the residents and business owners to make that happen.
Roughly how many businesses, how many residences were affected this time?
I don't have the exact numbers. I know that it's, a good bit of residents, probably, you know, less than 100, but maybe about 100 residents not being able to move back in. And with businesses, it varies. But, you know, compared to what happened in 2016, we certainly are going to, unfortunately, lose more businesses than we did back then. After 2016, as you mentioned in your introductory comments, 96% of the businesses came back, which was unheard of. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, told us back in 2016, we'd be lucky if 30% came back. And that's kind of like the average to have only about 30% come back. And we had 96, plus 20 new businesses come. So we actually were doing very, very well. Understandably, now that we've had the second flood, some businesses are saying we're not going to go through that again, and we won't have 96%. But I still think we'll have more than a majority coming back.
There was a master plan for Ellicott City underway after 2016 that was scheduled to be released soon or right around now. And then you've delayed that, given the fact that, you know, we're now dealing with yet another flood event. Right. So how will that master plan be informed by this event here in 2018? And when do you expect folks will get a chance to take a look at it?
Yeah, the Department of Planning and Zoning was working on that with a lot of folks in the community, and they were getting close to releasing something for everyone to review. And they've pulled it back, and quite understandably, to make sure they can kind of take into account what had happened on May 27th. And so I don't have a date for that. I know that they're looking to have some more meetings with community folks to talk about that. So I don't have all the details about that. I actually, you know, that's a plan that's been put together by experts in the community. I haven't seen the final plan itself. So I know that's coming soon. And you know, we'll incorporate some of the new ideas on, you know, Councilman John Weiss and I have been saying since the flood on May 27th, this is a new conversation. There are people in Ellicott City who have come to us who are probably now more willing to look at some different types of solutions to this problem that were not really willing to look at it 2 years ago. Because as you said, and I know I've said the same thing, where it's like a once in a thousand year storm. Technically what it is it's a 1/1000th chance of that happening. It's not necessarily 1,000 year. And so I thought back in 2016, this was not going to happen in my lifetime for sure. And so we'll do what we can to improve where we can, but we won't have to worry about that one again. And of course it came again. And so we have to have a new conversation, and that's what we're doing right now with the business owners and the property owners and the residents.
Ellicott City was founded in the 1700s as a
1772.
Mill town. And it was founded as a mill town because of the confluence of all of the rivers and streams that came into that area. So it's surrounded by these steep slopes for folks who may not have ever visited this beautiful area called Old Ellicott City. It's on the bank of a river, Patapsco River. Mm-hmm. There are these two other rivers that come in. I mean, so it's flooded many, many times in the 250-some years.
Well, it's actually 246 years old, and it had at least 16 or 17 recorded floods. And, you know, there have been ones that have come up from the river up, like Agnes did in 1972, and 1868 had a terrible flood. But we've also had terrible floods from the top down. 1952, we had one. 1858, we had one. So it's amazing how often it happens, but you're right. The Ellicott brothers built it there because of the water coming down, and they wanted to have water come down at a very fast speed to turn the mill. The problem, I think, is that for the first 246 years of Ellicott City's existence, we've tried to tell the river what to do. And we try to say we can build on the river, we can make the river listen to us. And unfortunately, the river doesn't listen to us, and we need to figure out how we can better now work and coexist with the river, with the Tiber, the Hudson, and the New Cut branches, and not try to force ourselves on them. And I think that's going to have to be a solution for the future.
A lot of folks think that if you do rebuild, however many businesses decide to rebuild, however many residents decide to move back in, that rebuilding shouldn't happen until there is some sort of, you know, completion on some of these remediation projects that can help protect against another dramatic event like this. That obviously changes the timetable for rebuilding and reopening the city, et cetera. What do you think about that?
Well, I think for sure life safety has to be our most important priority here. And, you know, you mentioned that we lost two lives in July of 2016. I look at it as we actually lost three lives, because a month later, a gentleman died while he was working on his building, John Pazlowski. So I consider us losing three lives as a result of the first flood. And we, of course, lost Sergeant Herman in the second flood. You know, that's certainly foremost in my mind, is how can we make sure that nobody has a chance to lose their life again. We want to make sure that that's for sure going to happen. But I can tell you, Frederick had terrible flooding back in 1976. They put together a program to mitigate that. That program just finished not that long ago. So Ellicott City, I think there are ways in which we can make Ellicott City safer and continue to thrive, because it's not going to be fixed overnight. We had a lot of projects already in the works from the flood in 2016 that were in the stages of being designed and engineered, and construction was going to start next spring on these. So it takes a while to make it happen there. So I think Ellicott City continue to thrive while we're doing this mitigation. I don't think we should just close the town and wait for 20 years to get all the mitigation, or 10 years to get all the mitigation done.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today, Alan Kittleman. He's the county executive of Ellicott, or of Howard County, which includes Ellicott City. And we're talking about the reaction and the response and the future of that town, given the fact that they've just endured the second of a very, very, pair of very, very serious floods. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page, and a little bit later, we will take your calls and comments. There are some folks who've suggested some intermediate steps that aren't particularly expensive. Joseph Rutter, who's a former planning director in Howard County and a business owner on Main Street, has said you can do things like prohibiting parking on Main Street, because if a flood comes, those cars that are parked on Main Street become these projectiles. They become these battering rams. Do the same thing by chaining down large trash bins, putting guardrails around the parking lots. Those do seem like fairly inexpensive things to do. Of course, you prohibit parking on Main Street. The businesses there may have some feelings about that. But in terms of really short-term, we can do this next week kind of stuff, what's on the list?
Well, I can see some of those are on the list. I think that's something we can think about. I can tell you the parking was a big issue after 2016. We prohibited parking for quite some time after 2016 as the rebuilding was going on. And we had a lot of discussions on keeping parking off forever. But I can tell you the great majority of the business owners did not want us to take parking off of Main Street. They felt it was important and vital to their business success to have the parking on Main Street, especially the businesses on the lower end of Main Street. And so we certainly, you know, I'm here to try to make sure these businesses are successful as I can. And again, we're looking at a storm that we thought was not going to happen again for well past my lifetime. So I think these are all, as I say, a new discussion, a new conversation. So we'll be looking at that possibility of not having parking on Main Street. I think that's certainly something we have to look at. I think everything else that Mr. Rutter talked about are certainly reasonable. We can be looking at how to do that. And they are certainly, those are very short-term things. We have, that's not going to stop a flood. And I know Mr. Rutter knows that, but it maybe would help the cars from not going down the road some more. But you know, the bigger issue is how do we slow down the water, and how do we make the water pass through the town in a safe way?
There were about 18 projects that were recommended from this hydrology and hydraulic study, which was completed spring of last year, 2017, and yet a few of them were underway.
Yep.
What's your understanding, your sense of the full total of what it would cost to really address this problem in a complete and thorough way?
Well, I know the McCormick study, which you talked about, we call it the H&H, the hydraulic and hydrology studies, had about, I think the cost was about $80 million is what we're looking at. I think we can maybe do it for less than that if we have some other ideas that maybe we're not part of that because, like I say, it's a new conversation and we're looking at ways in which we can maybe open up the stream channel and expand the capacity of the stream channel. So it might be a little less than that. I mean, but there are a lot of things that, you know, we're working with the state of Maryland. We've already met with the Secretary Brinkley, for the governor's budget secretary, along with leaders of the legislature. We had a meeting with them talking about how the state could maybe help us. I know back when Frederick had their terrible floods back in 1976, the state and the local government partnered to help put that mitigation effort together. We're going to be looking to the state to help us as well. I mean, Ellicott City, it's really important to remember, Tom, Ellicott City is a town worth saving. I mean, some people might think, hey, you know, we shouldn't be putting our money into that. I disagree with that. I mean, Ellicott City, like I say, will be 250 years old in 2022. It's the location of the first passenger train station in the history of the United States, the B&O train station there in Ellicott City. It is the place where the famous Tom Thumb train versus horse race occurred, went from Baltimore to Ellicott City. There's so much history there and so much economic activity there that it's worth saving. And there's ways in which we can do that in a way that will keep life safety as a priority, but also have the economic activity continuing on. So I'm looking forward to working with the residents of Ellicott City and Howard County, making that happen and getting support from the state.
I guess it comes down to a certain level, on a certain level, to what saving Ellicott City means. Mm-hmm. I mean, is saving Ellicott City possible if it doesn't have a whole bunch of businesses, if it doesn't have a whole bunch of people living in that downtown Main Street area? I mean, can it be saved? Can a saved Ellicott City look even dramatically different in 10 years than it does now.
I think it can. And I think there's ways in which, and we're not talking about, you know, we're looking at purchasing some properties and maybe open a stream channel, but we're not talking about taking a majority of the businesses away here. I think actually by doing that, we'll be encouraging more businesses to come. And I think that there'll be businesses saying, hey, the county now, because of the second storm, and we know now that we're going to have these type of storms on a more frequent basis. I've mentioned before to some people, this is the new normal. And what I meant by that was we have to expect these type of storms to happen more frequently. We never had those frequencies before when I was younger growing up in Howard County. And so that being the case, we had to figure out how we can make Ellicott City work with those types of storms. So that's why I think we can make it happen. And I don't think it means we lose that many businesses. I think what it means is we have to make sure that they have other areas to maybe locate. But that town is going to be really strong. And I tell you, in 250 years from now, they're going to go back and say, I remember in 2018, the residents of Ellicott City made the decisions that we needed to make to have this town continue to flourish another 250 years.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today for the hour, Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman. He's a Republican. He's running for re-election against a Democratic County Council member, Dr. Calvin Ball, in November. Whoever wins that race will work with a 5-member county council that will be entirely new. In the primary last month, a newcomer to the political scene, Liz Walsh, beat first-term incumbent Councilman John Weinstein in the primary by just 2 votes in the district that includes Ellicott City. A recount, of course, is underway, or will be underway pretty soon. Alan Kittleman is here in Studio A. You can join us when we come back. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Stick around. We will be right back. Back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a roundtable discussion on immigration. We'll get an update and analysis about the separations and detentions of thousands of migrant families over the past few months. Immigration attorney Ophelia Calderon, Kristen Strain of the Tahrir Justice Center, and law professor from Washington, Lindsay Harris, will join me to talk about immigration. That's coming up tomorrow on midday. If you're just joining us today, Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman is my guest. Later this summer, I'll speak with his opponent in the general election, County Council member Dr. Calvin Ball. This is all part of our series of conversations with the candidates. We're talking about the recent catastrophic flooding in Ellicott City. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWYPR, and we are streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Mr. County Executive, how much dedicated funding is there now in Howard County to address problems like what happened in Ellicott City and just storm remediation in general?
When you talk about dedicated funding, if you're looking at flood mitigation, we certainly put a lot of money into that after the last flood. We put a lot of money into it. We had about $11 million is what we thought was our public infrastructure cost from the flood in 2016. We did get the federal emergency declaration from President Obama. And so we are getting about 75% of that reimbursed to us. This time, it looks like we have about $20 million in public infrastructure costs as a result of this flood. As you probably already know, the president has already authorized that federal disaster assistance for us in Howard County. We appreciate our federal partners, Senator Cardin, Senator Van Hollen, and Congressman Cummings have been very supportive, as well as Governor Hogan. So this is actually the perfect example of how the federal, state, and local government can work so well together to get something done, regardless of party politics. And so that's kind of where we are right now. And so when you talk about dedicated, it's like it's what we need to rebuild Ellicott City. And we're focusing on what we need to do. We'll be going to the county council. We went to them before the end of the fiscal year to get about $3 million transferred over from other funds to make sure we had the money to get through this fiscal year. But now that we are in a new fiscal year, we'll be going probably back to the county council in the fall to look at what we need to do the rest of the job.
Well, there's a meeting tonight, of course. You did get a phone call from the White House after this happened last month. What transpired in that phone call?
It really was not a very long phone call. I got a call from the person who does intergovernmental affairs, just letting me know that they were certainly watching what was going on. Wasn't a very long conversation at all. Most of my my conversations have been with our federal representatives. I've talked to Senator Cardin and Senator Van Hollen quite often, as well as Congressman Cummings, and certainly with Governor Hogan. Governor Hogan was there that night and was able to declare an emergency for the state right away, which we had to have, of course, before we could even ask for the federal emergency. So, like I say, this is an example of how it's supposed to be. This is how we're supposed to work. We're supposed to put party politics aside and make sure we're doing what's best for the people. And I think a Republican governor and Democratic federal lawmakers all came together with a Republican county executive and a Democratic county council member. And we're all working really strong together to make sure that the right things are done for the people of Ellicott City. And right now, I think we're doing as well as could be expected.
The Democratic county council member you're mentioning, John Weinstein, lost his primary, or at least at the moment. He's not been declared the winner by 2 votes. Liz Walsh is the person who at the moment has been declared the winner in that race. Mm-hmm. Have you spoken with Ms. Walsh about this as well?
I have not. I have not seen Ms. Walsh. I saw her on Election Day when I was traveling around to the polling places, but I have not talked to her, and I've only communicated through text messages with Councilman Weinstein.
You mentioned this study, this H&H study, hydraulic and hydrology report done by McCormick Taylor, a consulting firm. They estimated that about $35 million in immediate improvements were needed, including building these 3 large retention ponds to catch the rainwater before it floods down the street, stuff like that. And then there's long-term recommendations, and you mentioned it's in the neighborhood of $80 million. Some people have said $85 million. When are you looking to have a master plan that everybody agrees to, everybody buys into, everybody says, yep, this is what we're doing, and then go out to raise however much money that master plan is estimated to cost?
Well, we're already working on some of the projects that you said that the H&H study showed. I mean, the retention pond at U.S. Route 29 and Route 40, we're working with on an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, with the State of Maryland, State Highway Administration. So that's already in the works. It's been designed, engineered. We actually have the funding for it. There's another stormwater pond we call Quaker Mill, which is on Rogers Avenue. Design's being done. Engineering's been done. We already have money to go forward with that one as well. We have a culvert that is like one of the pinch points right there on the west end of Main Street, A600 block of West Main Street. And we have the funds already, some from FEMA and some from Howard County, to improve that culvert. So there are a lot of things that were part of the study that we've already been going forward on. And I think it's also important for people to realize that even after I was elected in 2014, before even the flood in 2016, Councilman Weinstein and I put together an Ellicott City flood group to start talking about this because of the previous floods in Ellicott City. And so we've been working on this well before the flood in 2016. So that's why we're probably farther ahead than most people would be had they just had a flood and not had any thought of what they were going to be doing. So we have a lot of projects already in the pipeline. And, you know, as the master plan process comes through after they adapted to based upon the most recent flood, we'll certainly be working on those as well.
We have an email from Angie who says the discussion about prevention projects in old Ellicott City is good, but what is the county planning in land use policies and increased stormwater management requirements to prevent future flooding? And the rest there and in the rest of the county, there were hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage in surrounding neighborhoods from the recent flood. Should we still call it a targeted growth area?
Well, Ellicott City, Councilman Weinstein and the county council and I signed legislation last year that increased the requirements of stormwater management already. We've already done that to make sure that what's being built in the watershed has to be built to the 100-year floodplain, storm. And so we've done that. We're now looking at a moratorium for a year. Councilman Weinstein put that in. All 4 other council members support it. I support that to give us more time to look at how we can move forward with this. Unfortunately, much of the development in the watershed, and it's not a very big watershed, we're talking about 3-square-mile watershed, was done before stormwater regulations existed. And when you have that happen, it makes it much more difficult. And so a lot of times the folks who do redevelop, it's actually somewhat better than what was there before because at least now they do have stormwater requirements. And so we're certainly looking very closely at that. For me as county executive, the most important thing for me to do is to make sure that the rules are implemented. In the past, too often, certain rules would be waived and not required. That's not happening under my watch. Everybody has to do what they're required to do under the law. The zoning is done by the county council and the zoning board, who sits at the county council, because I did that back for 6 years back in the late 90s. Those are the issues we got to deal with. We need to make sure that we don't have zoning that gets increased. What happens quite often, Tom, is that you have a property that's zoned for a certain number of houses, then they go to the zoning board and they get increased for another 100 houses there, 100 units. We need to watch what that's been happening. And unfortunately, the zoning board over the past 12, 10 years have increased a lot of the zoning in that watershed, and that's a problem. But as county executive, that's what the law allows them to do, and I have to make sure they follow the rules.
Alan Kittleman is the county executive of Howard County. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780, to drop us an email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet, @MiddayWYPR. You can also ping us on Facebook, where we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. John in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with County Executive Alan Kittleman.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Doing great, John. How are you?
Good, good. I'm glad that the report from the HA study has come through and that you're giving it some consideration. I think it's kind of a shame that you're accepting this most recent data and not the data that was published leading up to the need for the stormwater remediation fee. So my question is, how do you plan to undo the damage that the negative campaign by calling the stormwater remediation fee a rain tax? What that's done in the public image of why this is a necessary fee, why infrastructure is important, and why it's important for everybody involved in the city to get behind this. Because I think it was at least 2 days after the flood in Ellicott City that Governor Hogan put up a Facebook ad calling it the rain tax, which seemed pretty tone deaf to me. So wondering what your thoughts on this all were.
No, thank you, John. Thank you very much for the comment. I think it's an important comment to make, and it's important for me to be able to address that because I think there's some misinformation out there. What people need to realize is that the stormwater remediation fee cannot be used for flood mitigation, point blank. I was in the Senate when we passed the stormwater watershed remediation and restoration fee, I should say, and is for quality control, is to try to reduce the sediment and nutrients that are going to the Chesapeake Bay. For flood mitigation, that's not what you're doing. You're dealing with quantity control. You're not dealing with quality control. And so we have been advised that the stormwater restoration fee cannot be used for flood mitigation projects. So I think it's important for people to realize that. I mean, we've been using the fee to deal with projects in Howard County that are reducing sediment and some stream erosions and things like that. But to try to deal with thousands and thousands of gallons of water going down a big hill going into Patapsco River, that is not what the fee is allowed to be used for.
But doesn't the storm remediation fee also address, in addition to the, you know, the stuff that were thrown into the Chesapeake Bay, the number of and the square acreage of impervious surfaces that contribute to the flooding? Right? I mean, it is related to flooding in some direct way, is it not?
Well, they use that to determine how much you need to remediate, is how much impervious first surface you have, but you cannot use it to deal with flood mitigation projects. That, I mean, the whole purpose of the fee, because I was sitting in the Senate when we did it, the whole purpose of the fee was not to deal with flooding, it was to deal with sediment control and nutrients going into the bay. It was all about preserving the bay, which is a very important goal. But so I think people need to realize when you're looking at thousands of gallons of water coming down a hill in an hour, that's not what we're trying. So when we build these huge stormwater retention ponds, when we put these huge culverts in to try to help the water to be going around the buildings instead of going into the buildings, when we deal with ways in which we can open the stream channels, that is not something that the stormwater restoration fee was expected to do. That's water quantity control, not quality control.
How do you think the branding, as John brings up in his comment, how do you think the branding of that fee as a rain tax, whether you call it a fee or a tax, but to call it the rain tax, the governor said as he was running for office the last time around, and you supported mm-hmm. him in this, that, you know, they're going to tax the rain. Mm-hmm. It just sounds like a terrible, terrible thing. And then there's two floods that are directly related to rainfall. Is it a good idea in principle to have certain monies sequestered to do stormwater remediation?
I think that when you're looking at the quality, if you're talking about stormwater for flood mitigation, I think that, you know, we all are working together, and that's what we're doing in Howard County. We're coming together as a county to make sure we have the funds necessary, working with the state to get the funds necessary, just like they did in Frederick, that's what they've done in other counties, to give us the way to we can mitigate the flood. To deal with the problems of quality control that we're trying to save our Chesapeake Bay, which is, of course, very, very important. I've lived here all my life, and I love the Bay, and I spent a lot of my time on the Bay when I was a kid. That is something, again, I think it should be a combined effort on. And so when people say whether or not we need to have the fee or not, I think it could be something that could be through our regular tax dollars, our regular we don't have to have maybe a separate dedicated fee for that. And that's why I didn't support having a separate dedicated fee when I was in the Senate or as county executive.
County Council disagreed with you on that. They did not allow your proposal to repeal the fees to go through. They had some reservations about the plan that you've just outlined to get grants and reserve balance and general obligation funds, et cetera, to pay for it. But you are still convinced that there's enough money in the general fund of Howard County to deal with the impervious surfaces and regulating them in some way, reducing them if possible, preventing their expansion?
Yes, I am, because also we put an awful lot of money into our wastewater treatment plant. We have probably the best, if not one of the best in the whole country. And the state of Maryland, working with environmental groups, is looking at ways in which we can do some trading with what the money we have invested into our stormwater treatment plant can be used to mitigate some of the requirements for the quality control into the Bay. So I think we're way ahead of the game in Howard County. Montgomery County is way behind, and they're actually under consent order, I believe. And so we're doing very well in Howard County, and I think that we can continue to go forward and without having to tax our citizens even more.
There are certain counties that have it, certain counties that don't. The city does. The Baltimore County does not. Howard County does. The stormwater projects, as of about 3 years ago, were costing Howard County, as I understand it, about $10 million a year. Has that number stayed constant? And these are stormwater projects. This is not flood mitigation.
Right. Right.
So the money you are spending on specifically stormwater projects, where does that stand here in 2018?
I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. It's probably about right. What you're saying is probably about right. We're also using those to leverage bonding, and that's what you basically do. You're using leverage bonding so you can build just like you do for school construction and for roads and everything like that. So I think your number's relatively right, but I can't guarantee that.
The Democrats on the county council, when they refused to accept your proposal to repeal the stormwater remediation fees, said that there's great support for those fees among citizens of Howard County. You seem to indicate that you didn't think there was, but what's your understanding of how your constituents feel about it now, given these two events? I mean, obviously, when it comes to politics, Democrats outnumber Republicans in Howard County 2-1, and that's a similar proportion statewide, and Governor Hogan's bill. We should also mention that, Mike Miller, Rich Modolino, Jamie Raskin, who was in the Senate at the time, Mayor Pugh, they also supported repeal of this law. This is not a Republican thing by any means, and the repeal, went through. But what's your notion of how Howard Countyans feel about whether or not this fee being assessed? And they range from $15 a year to $90 a year, depending on where you're living. What do you think? How do you think they really think they feel about it?
Well, there's a split, of course. I mean, there's some that think it's a good idea, some who don't. I mean, I'm of the opinion that I think it should be part of our regular budget. We shouldn't have a dedicated fee for that. It should come out of our regular budget dollars. I know that there's a lot of concerns about the effect on commercial businesses and how a lot of them are paying a lot higher fee and costs that makes it difficult for their business to survive. And so I think that it's something that we can continue to look at. I know that the county council, after our efforts to repeal were not successful, did put in some legislation to try to make it a little easier for our commercial companies and businesses to deal with it. But, the long and short of it is, I think we all agree that we need to get to a way in which we can help the Bay to improve. And I'm glad to hear the Bay is getting better already. But it seems to me that the issue is, where do you get the money? I think the money can come from our regular tax structure, not having another separate dedicated fee.
Alan Kittleman is the county executive of Howard County. We're talking about the future of Old Ellicott City and other issues on the minds of people in Howard County. You are welcome to join us when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. That's our phone number here on Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we take a break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence here in Baltimore City in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far, this year, here in 2018, 146 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. One male victim that we reported the week before last had been shot 19 years ago, who died in June of last year from complications from that gunshot wound. 2 weeks ago, the medical examiner ruled his death a homicide, but his identity was not released by police until this week. He was James King. He was 35 years old at the time of his death. Last week, there were 7 reported victims of homicide in Baltimore. 5 men and 1 woman have not yet been identified by Baltimore police. The one person who died by violence last week whose identity has been released is Omari Foster. He was 31 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Alan Kittleman. He has been the Howard County Executive since 2014. He's a Republican, and he faces Democratic County Council member Dr. Calvin Ball on the ballot in November. Mr. Kittleman is 59 years old. He and his wife, Robin, live in West Friendship. They have 4 children. Before being elected as County Executive, Mr. Kittleman represented parts of Carroll and Howard counties in the Maryland Senate for 10 years. He oversees a county with a population of about 321,000 people and a budget of about $1.6 billion. You're welcome to join our conversation with County Executive Kittleman, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to tweet us at @MiddayWYPR, and you can also find us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Mr. Kittleman, we have a few emails here.
Good.
Matt from Catonsville says, given the double flood risk to properties below Old Columbia Pike to the Patapsco River from both the river and streams, wouldn't it make sense to get the residents and businesses out of that area and purchase those properties for expanding the Patapsco State Park? This was done in Harper's Ferry, most flood-prone areas, and made into a living museum. So again, here's one of several suggestions about, you know, how to just reconfigure Ellicott City.
Right. No, and I appreciate Matt bringing that up. And we actually have had those discussions. And when I said earlier it's a new conversation, I really meant by that we have business owners, property owners coming to us saying, we think maybe you should consider buying us and doing something similar to what Matt was saying. So we certainly are looking into that. And Councilman Weinstein and I had a town hall where we discussed part of that transformative vision for Ellicott City. And that's certainly part of it, to work with some of the businesses and property owners and residents and see, hey, are some people here willing to look at doing that as a way of mitigating?
Denise sends an email, says, I'm a resident in the historic district of Ellicott City and frequently attend council meetings, planning and zoning meetings, and master plan meetings. The development that has occurred in the past 10 years and that is in progress now has been approved with waivers to code and preservation guidelines in the watershed area. What will be your commitment to stop the excessive waivers when development is undergoing approval?
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Denise. I've already done that. I think people need to realize that developments that you see now, it takes about 3 or 4 years for development to happen. But by the time they go through their design phases, go through everything else. So anything you see being developed now was all approved before I was even in office. And so that's what I think is important for people to realize. So you have to look at, that's why I tell everybody, go back and look at the zoning changes. That's what really affects development, is the zoning changes to where was increased density allowed. Now, there are some issues with waivers, and my department, we do not issue very many waivers. And if you look at the statistics, there are less waivers have been issued by my administration than the previous administrations. And so we are very dedicated. I mean, I have a reputation. It's kind of funny to say this. I have a reputation among folks that I'm a rule follower. And I think that's what you want as a county executive. I mean, if the county council passes legislation, even zoning legislation, and says this is what's allowed, I make sure it does what it says they can do. If someone says, I want to cut through a steep slope, or I want to do something that's not allowed by that, we want you to waive that, we don't do that. And we certainly don't do that in Ellicott City. So we are being very strong on our requirements, that people follow the rules. And that's what I think I'm supposed to do as a county executive.
Part of the consultant report that you've received calls for some long-term things like drilling two tunnels, big tunnels, through the town's hills. It would cost more than $60 million, and it would redirect the water away from downtown. When you hear ideas like that, you talk about all these things that are under consideration, things that it's a new conversation. But are there things that people have suggested that for you are non-starters, that are off the table, things that you're not going to think about pursuing?
Well, I wouldn't say that they're not going to be thought about. I think that $60 million boring the holes in may be something that's not practicable. I think there are other ways, especially now that we've had this horrific second flood, there are other opportunities to us that we can figure out ways for the water to be redirected into Patapsco that doesn't require those $60 million boring of holes, tunnels.
Don says, Mr. Kittleman, I informally interviewed several shop owners before the last flood, and the consensus is that most shop owners do not have and cannot afford insurances for their business, flood insurance for their businesses. This factor may be a major negative incentive for existing or departed shop owners to try once again to rebuild. Can the county provide help to these shop owners to mitigate the risk going forward to having their businesses on Main Street? Is the county going to get in the insurance business?
County won't get in the insurance business, but as Don may know, I think more folks had insurance this time than had last time because of what happened, because I've talked to several people who have insurance this time. But one thing that we can do is by working with FEMA, and we didn't announce it after because the flood happened, but we, because of our efforts, our mitigation efforts already thus far, the way that FEMA charges for their flood insurance is based upon a scale, and we actually have improved our rating on that scale so that the cost of flood insurance will go down for residents in the Ellicott City, Howard County area because of what we're doing. And so the best thing we can do to help people is by continuing doing the flood mitigation efforts we're working on that make it less likely to have a devastating flood. That would make the flood insurance go down.
Let's go to the phones. Nancy in Baltimore City, you've been patient and waiting on the line to speak with Mr. Kittleman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much.
Hi, Nancy.
I am a Baltimore City resident, and I understand that we're talking about a combination of state funds as well as county funds. But when I look at $80 million or $35 million, it just makes me think of Baltimore City residents for whom that would do so much to provide safe housing for people, to get homeless people into housing. I love Ellicott City, and I value its history, but I think that our money needs to go to those kinds of problems rather than to a middle-class suburban community that is how I see Ellicott City.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment, Nancy. I appreciate it. You know, you've got folks outside of Howard County that you're going to have to convince when it comes to funding the rebuilding of this. And a lot of folks say this is a problem of your own making. It's overbuilt, and now you're asking everybody else to bail you out.
No, I appreciate that. It's also a comment we have throughout Howard County, because there are places in Howard County. And that's why it's important to talk about the economics also of this. Ellicott City is a big economic driver in Howard County, but also the state of Maryland. It's a place that actually helps us with our tax revenues to be able to do things that Nancy talked about. And I just wanted Nancy to know that I think we can do both. I don't think we can say it's either or. Do we help Ellicott City survive? Do we help Ellicott City move on to be even a stronger town in the future? Or do we help those who may be homeless? In Howard County, we have, during my watch, we put up a homeless shelter in Howard County, 35 efficiency apartments there, plus a first floor that provides medical treatment, educational opportunities, counseling and therapy, and some other things for folks who are homeless. So we are focusing on our homeless population, but I think we can do both, and we can do both successfully.
We have an email from Ann on a slightly different subject. Please ask the county executive what he sees as the potential use of the county courthouse building when the court is relocated to Columbia.
Great point, Ann. Thank you so much for bringing that up. We are relocating our courthouse. Our courthouse is very, very old, and it's put in an area where we really can't renovate it. We have one of the most inadequate, especially for those who may be under ADA requirements, and so for technology. So we're moving our courthouse to another location. And I think that is a big part of the discussion. I think as we have a master plan for the courthouse in Ellicott City, we did something similar for the Long Reach Village Center. We had a reimagined plan. I think we should do something similar here, have a reimagined Ellicott City plan for the courthouse. We could have a lot of the businesses who may be leaving the lower end of Main Street move up to where that courthouse is. We could have other things there that will continue to thrive and help Ellicott City to be thrive, I mean. And so, yeah, it's a big part of the discussion, Ann. Thank you very much for bringing it up. And I want everyone to know that we're going to make sure that the community is very involved in how we pursue that.
Chris on Facebook is one of those folks who says this is a problem that is of the making of Howard County to begin with. And to ask everybody else to bail you out isn't a very fair idea. He says, note how much green space there is in Baltimore County. That's all helping to absorb the water, the green space. Then you look at the Howard County side and the massive residential and commercial developments. It's one of the wealthiest counties in the state, in the country for that matter.
If I could share that, I would tell folks from Baltimore County, Owella and Cadesville had a lot of damage in this last flood. So if it wasn't just the Howard County developments, and you know, Howard County has a lot of people there who have lived there for a long, long time, but you know, a lot of these developments didn't have stormwater management when they came in, as I said earlier on. So we're dealing with those issues. And so, I mean, the same thing could be said about Frederick. The state of Maryland gave a lot of money to Frederick when they rebuilt after their flood in 1976. So that is the way we all come together as a community. And, you know, Howard County certainly provides our fair share to the state of Maryland. I would say that Howard County, maybe Montgomery County, maybe another two things. We give much more money to the state of Maryland than we get back from the state of Maryland. So we, I think, as a county, do an awful lot to help our neighboring jurisdictions. And so I don't see this as a us versus them. I think we are a regional community. I'm Baltimore-centric myself. I've always been that way. I supported the Orioles, the Baltimore Colts when I was a kid. And so I very much focus on how we can all work together as a region. Mayor Pugh and I served on the Senate Finance Committee 8 years together. We're good friends. We work together very well. And so I think this is something where we all work together. We don't look at it as us versus them.
Let's go back to the phones. Henry in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Mr. Kittleman.
Yes, I've got kind of two parts to a question. Mm-hmm. First, I think the hydraulic study was done. And as an engineer, I'm interested in that because that should tell you how you solve the problem, if it can be solved, and what the cost would be. And I guess the other thing would be, in the hydraulic study, did they find out, was it overdevelopment that caused this, or improper stormwater management in the developments? And if it was, who made that decision to let that go through? Because that cost people their lives.
I appreciate your comments, Henry. I'll look at go to both of them. Yes, the H&A study does do modeling, and it does show how the water came down in the flood back in 2016, because that's when the study was done after that flood. And we can use that to show what we might do to change it. How would that affect the water coming down the hill if we had some of these stormwater retention ponds, if we purchased a couple buildings and maybe expanded the stream channel? How would that change the flooding in the future? So that's exactly what we've been using that for. And with regard to the cause, I think there's no question that development contributed to this problem. The study, if you read the study, it will say that had we had what they call green forest, we would have had a similar flood without any development whatsoever because of the topography. Again, this is why the Ellicott brothers came here, because it was a very steep slope and you have three streams coming together into one larger stream to go into the Patapsco. But I don't think there's any question in my mind that we have to deal with some of the development issues. And that's why I don't put that off at all. I just think it's important for people to realize this was a combination of factors. It isn't, you know, that it was just development. It isn't that it was just the topography. It's all those working together. And unfortunately, most of those decisions were probably made 20, 30 years ago. And so we are dealing with decisions that were made a long time ago. But again, they go back to the zoning board. And so the current zoning board, the county council, and those who were served on the county council for the last 12 years, you have to look at what votes they did to increase the density. I know in College Avenue, there's 800 homes that have been authorized there that were authorized by the current county council. So not the current county council, the council back 4 years ago. So those are the issues we're dealing with.
Alan Kittleman was elected as the county executive of Howard County in 2014. He is standing for re-election in the fall. His opponent is Howard County Council member Dr. Calvin Ball. We will be inviting Dr. Ball to be on our program later this summer. It's all part of our Conversations with the Candidates series. You can hear all of those interviews with the folks who are running in the key races throughout Maryland on our website, wypr.org/midday. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with experts in immigration and asylum law about the separations and detentions of thousands of migrant families over the past few months. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to The Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall on behalf of the entire Midday team. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.